This is CFRO-FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Gas is expensive. We all have the nagging feeling it may get a lot more expensive. World oil fields are getting drained out at almost 85 million barrels a day for our carbon habit. And burning it up is heating the earth, threatening everything. What to do? This is Alex Smith, your host on Radio EcoShock. While many of you were on vacation, I recorded a super panel, six very different voices, about the concurrent problems of peak oil and climate change. It all happened in a hall of the Ukrainian Church in Vancouver, August 17th. Gregory Greene's new film, Escape from Suburbia, was the big draw. We covered the film and did a long interview with the director on our August 10th show. Hundreds of people are still downloading that one from our website, free. But this was a crowd ready for action. Instead of disappearing after the film, they stayed for the panel. They are, in the order you will hear them speak, Conrad Schmidt, founder of the Work Less Party and the World Naked Bike Ride, John Stonier, director of the BC Sustainable Energy Association. From the film, Jan Steinman, the tech guru who says it's time to get out of town. Ifni Lachance is an activist working with the Free Geek Computer Recycling Company. And finally, Richard Balfour is an architect and city planner. A real mix. Thanks to Frank and Justin for letting Radio EcoShock listeners in on the party. Now, to the hall.
Okay, hello everybody. My name is Justin Roller. I'm a scientist and I work in the fuel cell industry. And like Frank said earlier, I moved up here from Atlanta about 3 years ago. And Frank actually introduced me to the whole idea of peak oil. And I always joke that I used to be happy until I met him. And now I'm going to learn to milk a cow. So who wants to join me? But it was great to see that movie. And it really follows on the end of Suburbia. And what I like especially about this movie is the fact that we move away from talking about what is the problems that we're facing and to what people are really doing in their own lives. And that's kind of the idea that Frank and I had for this evening, was to screen this movie and to get people together and to get people to start thinking about, in their own terms, in their own lives, what do they want to do? How do they want to deal with this? What does the future look like? What is the future that we want to look like? And so part of that is bringing together these panelists here. And we've got a great diverse group of panelists. I'm just going to take a minute to introduce each one. We have Richard Balfour here. He is an architect and a city planner, and he's been involved in city planning around peak oil ideas and what cities can do, what they might look like, some scenario planning. And he'll be speaking on his perspective of peak oil. We have Ifni Lachance, who I've spelled her name a little wrong. She's LaChane tonight.
LaChaney,
yeah, like Dick Cheney, right. She's an activist and an organizer, a sustainability advocate, and she's working currently on Free Geek, a computer recycling network. So she might have a few words to say about that, how recycling and reusing things might come into play in the future. We have Jan Steinman here. You might recognize him from the film, so we're very pleased to have him here. He came over from Salt Spring Island. We also have John Stonier. It's a pleasure to have John Stonier here. He is the director of the BCSEA, which is the BC Sustainable Energy Association. He also is the chief financial officer for Day 4 Energy. And I think is the director of the Vancouver Electric Vehicle Association. We also have Rex Weiler here. It's a pleasure to have Rex here. He is a journalist and an ecologist and a founding member of Greenpeace and has been around in the environmental movement for quite some time now. And we also have Conrad Schmidt, who's a political activist and community organizer. So what I thought we'd do is just start off with give each panelist about 5 minutes and explain who they are, what the movie meant to them, what does peak oil mean to them, what's their perspective on it. And you know, moving past what is just your perspective, but what is it? How has it changed your life? How has it changed your thinking of the future? So without further ado, I'll go ahead and start off with Conrad. And then after the panelists are done, we'll take questions from the audience. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Conrad.
Well, thank you very much. And it's a great honor to be here tonight. I did like the film, but I do have some concerns about it that I thought I'd bring up, and hopefully people won't throw too many tomatoes at me, but it's okay. In 1914, I know this is maybe it's a little different, but in 1914, the Department of Mines, they predicted peak oil. In 1929, the Federal Oil Conservation Board predicted peak oil. In 1939 and 1951, the Department of Internal Affairs was warning the American Congress that peak oil was imminent. Peak oil predictions, they've been going on now for around 100 years. Yes, it is true that the Hubbard's Curve, which is what this film is based on, was able to predict peak oil in the United States in the 1970s. But its predictions about world supply coming to an end in peak oil in 1989, 1995, and the year 2000 were all wrong. I'm not saying that peak oil is not coming. What I'm saying is that this film needs a little more, a little closer looking at some of the facts. One of my big concerns about this film was the speed with which it dismissed many of the alternatives. Running out of oil is actually not all that new. It's happened before. During the Second World War, Germany ran out of oil. What did they do? Well, they developed a synthetic fuel industry. 50% of the German army was running on synthetic fuels. The same thing happened in apartheid South Africa. South Africa was threatened with oil embargoes. What did they do? They developed a synthetic fuel industry that is commercially viable to this day, capable of producing up to 150,000 barrels a day. What is synthetic fuel? Synthetic fuel is the conversion of coal to liquid fuel, either diesel or petrol. And the bad news is, we have a lot of coal. One of my other big concerns with this film was the section on nuclear technology. Does anybody remember that section? No, it wasn't even there. That's a big thing to leave out. The world is currently scrambling to build nuclear reactors. I'm no big fan of nuclear technology. I think it's rather dangerous. But it is currently being labeled as the new cheap energy alternative. It's even being labeled as green. We currently have thousands of years left of uranium-233 and uranium-235. Nuclear technology has been powering cities for the last 50 years. It can, unfortunately, equally charge up electric cars or electric scooters. Talking about electric cars, does anybody remember that section in the film? No, it wasn't there either. It didn't make the director's cut. That's a big thing to leave out. I think my biggest concern with this film is near the end, where the director says that there are similarities between the environmental movement and the peak oil concern for peak oil. No, I think there are some big differences. Concern for the environment and species other than just human beings is very different to worrying about just oil running out. Currently, millions of species are going extinct. And the reason why they're going extinct is because we're killing their habitat. The stress created by consumerist society is destroying their habitat. And unfortunately, we have more than enough energy to finish the job substantially. I'm a fairly optimistic person, and I do believe there are real solutions, but they are solutions that we are going to have to come up with. And it is possible, but I don't think we're going to be running out of cheap energy and cheap energy alternatives. So that's just something I wanted to say. So don't throw too many tomatoes at me. Thank you.
Thank you, Conrad. Those were actually all very, very good points. One part of that, too, is that we have to remember that not all energy is created equal. And oil does tend to provide almost 90% of transportation, whereas nuclear cannot provide transportation unless we turn the whole car fleet over to electric. And there's a time delay there. But I agree with most of what you're saying. That's absolutely true.
I can also respond to that last bit.
Sure, sure. We can get onto that later on. Rex, would you like to say a few things for
about
5 minutes?
Just briefly. Here's a way to put this a little bit into perspective. I'm concerned sometimes a little bit when we think about what are the alternatives, because to a certain extent, there is no alternative to oil. Oil is what it is, and there's nothing like it. It's cheap. It's easy to get your hands on. It's simple to move around in pipes. You can pump it into your car and so forth. Yes, there are all alternatives. One of those alternatives is to use less energy. That's the main one that I'm trying to promote. Is to use less. But we talk about biodiesel, for example, biofuels. Oil is a biofuel. It's 400 million years worth of biofuel stored in the earth. 400 million years. We are going to use that. We're about 140 years into it, and might be another 140 years or 200 years left of oil. We're going to go through that in 250, 300 years. We are using a million, every year, we use 1.5 million years of stored oil. Think about that like a woodshed. Like I've lived in the bush, and I know what it's like to fill your woodshed. I know what it's like to like have 2 years worth of wood in your woodshed or a year and a half's worth of wood. It feels really good. Imagine 1 million years worth of, it takes you 1 million years to store your woodshed and you burn it in 1 year. That's what we're doing with oil. And it's very important that we get that perspective about oil. We have basically, we robbed the cookie jar. Humanity stumbled upon this bonanza of cheap, easy energy. We're halfway through it, roughly, and we're gonna burn the rest. So that's one thing. The second thing is, we should not be quibbling about the peak, because we're past the peak of everything. We're way past peak everything, and especially in relationship to population. So per capita oil peak was in the 1970s. So population has been outstripping oil. It's outstripping fish. The peak of fisheries from the oceans was in the 1960s, and I remember seeing that graph in the 1970s and realizing that the peak of fish was in the 60s and going, whoa. So now here we are, 30 years later, we've gone through half the forests on the planet. There used to be 8 billion hectares of forest. There's now 4. We're halfway through the forest. We're halfway through the oil. We're 90% through some of the fish species, etc. So I hope I'm not only adding to your depression about this, but I'm optimistic too, but I believe that we have to, you know, first, before you can be optimistic, you have to be realistic, because otherwise you're just being delusional. And the alternative is that we absolutely have to 100% change our lifestyle. That's my point. We are past the peak of everything. There's not a single resource on this planet that we are going to have more of in the future. And there's not a single resource on the planet that we're going to have more of per capita, even close. We're adding 75 million people a year to the planet. That's 10 New York cities per year. Are we building infrastructure for these people? Is there more farmland for these people? Are there more fish, more oil, more nothing? There's more nothing for those people. And the film mentioned this, but didn't spend a lot of time on it, but mentioned it, and it's something that's very important. The poorest people of the world are going to be the ones that feel all these impacts first. We're somewhat buffered from it. And I assure you that the billion people that are virtually living on the edge of starvation, they're the ones that are going to feel it first. We're the rich. We live in the rich 10 or 15% of the people that are using 85% of the resources. We've got lots of buffers between us and what I would actually call suffering. And the suffering that's going to go on, the Darfurs are all going to come first. This is going to hit the poorest of the poor first. That's another thing to think about. Anyway, I've got some optimistic points. I'll save them for later.
Thanks, Rex. Yeah. I think the figure is something like 90% of the large fish in the sea are gone. 90% of the large fish in the sea are gone. And that, when I read that, it blew my mind. And how much longer can we keep that going on? And recently in the news, we heard about the sockeye, or is it the coho, that have failed to return this year. So, yeah, it's right there. It's in the news. It's just, I don't know if it was Kunstler that said, simple failure to pay attention, really. John?
Thanks. well, I saw this film. This is I've seen it 1.5 times now, and I see this film as a real call to action. It's a great collage of what people can do, some of the players that are out there. I'm a CA, been working in business for virtually all my life, and behind business, I understand how business works. And when I see things, I take the spin that comes off of advertising and politicians, and I know what goes on behind businesses, and there's reasons why things happen. And the reasons, to me, are fairly clear. They're always based on vested interests, and the reason things don't change and the reasons why we don't do the right thing is because it's usually because somebody who's got some influence with the government is making sure things go the way they want it. So, you know, we have Hummers, and we have reports out there. There's one called Dust to Dust that claims that a Hummer is actually more environmentally friendly than a Prius. And there's people that are arguing this stuff. And the fact that it even exists is crazy. But back to the film, and I want to give you some real-life things that I think we can do. But I'll just point a couple of the problems. We have an infrastructure problem. Our infrastructure is all been based on oil and based on cheap energy and plenty of it. Every one of our buildings in this city today has huge resources of energy that are totally squandered. Every automobile, there's 800 million automobiles in the world. They're all internal combustion engines, and we have much better technologies. The electric car, as Conrad has brought up, is a huge technology that we can use today. And there's a reason why it's not used. The reason is that the car companies would lose money. They would have less revenue per car. An electric car has about 500 fewer parts than a regular car. That means it's cheaper to build, less parts to assemble, to machine, to cool, to lubricate. No maintenance, no after-sales parts. It uses one quarter of the energy to drive the same car the same distance. Our buildings are all built in North America because we've had such cheap energy. Every building that's every multi-tenant building in this city has wasted energy right now. I did an energy audit of our building in Kitsilano, 180 stalls in the parkade. I counted up every one of the 302 fluorescent tubes in that parkade that burned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. That is $15,000 worth of electricity that burns, and I can bet you that the lighting is nowhere near required. 5% of that lighting is required, but we're paying $15,000. If you converted those 60 of those 180 cars parked in that garage to electric, you could power all of them with all that power of the lights. And you could probably put motion sensor switching by zone and cut down 95%. In fact, for just the lighting in that parkade, you could power one-third of the cars that park there. And this technology is around today. Solar has been around for a long time, solar thermal. In 1986, Canada was one of the leading countries of solar thermal technology. In 1986, or I guess it was 85, when the Conservative government came in, our greenest Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney, was head of the government that canceled all the solar programs in 1985. Within 1 year, 85 companies in this country went out of business in the solar business. There is some technology today called evacuated tube solar thermal technology that is owned by Germans and produced in China. And it was designed and manufactured here in Canada back in the 80s. There's been lots of opportunities. The technology, there is no technology that we need to create. The electric car has been around for 105 years. Solar thermal has been around for as long as somebody's left something out in the sun to warm up. Solar PV has been around for 30 years, And you can now produce a panel that there's no reason why it can't last 200 years. All our solutions are here today. What we need is for our the people here to demand manufacturers to produce the right things, which means don't refuse to buy any new car until they produce electric cars that will cost you one-tenth the cost to drive per kilometer and will last 50, 100 years because basically there's nothing to break down other than replacing the batteries every 10 to 15 years. Demand, you know, people buy condos and nobody, they buy them in advance. There is no input. You get what you they deliver. And I can tell you developers build buildings today like they built them in the 60s. The only difference is that the faceplates are cheaper and the lights are now made in China instead of more quality lighting. There's no savings in energy. All these multi-tenant buildings have every common light burning 24 hours a day. There is no thought to integration. We have the solutions. So individuals can take things into their own hands. You can do an audit, energy audit of the building you live in right now. In our building in Kitsilano, we are putting on a solar thermal system that will pay itself back in 8 years. We will we've already changed some of our lights off, and we've you get a payback in some of the lighting situations in 7 months. It's economically great to do this. There's lots of good solutions. You just need to really sit down and think through some of these things. They're out there. And so I think this film is really a call to action. The individual can do this. Individuals in mass can change the business climate. You demand what the big companies produce, and they will produce it. They'll have to.
Thanks, John.
This is CFRO-FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, your alternative sound source. And you have found the Radio EcoShock Show. I'm Alex Smith, and today we're tuning into a panel on peak oil and climate change. This was recorded August 17, 2007 in Vancouver. So many different speakers, so many different solutions, but we all agree there is an energy crunch looming. Billions more people want to live just like us. In India, the Tata Company is bringing out the world's cheapest car, just $2,500. Drivers in China are competing with you at the world's biggest oil fields, and all that CO2 in the atmosphere is leading us to a different world and a not-so-friendly world.
If anybody would like to see a good documentary about electric cars, there's a good one called Who Killed the Electric Car, and a lot of those same points are brought up there, and it delves into electric cars in a little bit more detail. Okay, Jan?
Before the advent of fossil fuel, there were fewer than a billion people on Earth. Now we've got going on 7 billion. So the population rise has been lockstep with the availability of energy. This is an enormous problem. Before the advent of fossil fuel, there were 15 families on the land for everyone in the city. Now there are thousands in the city for everyone. This is a trend that is going to have to change. Perhaps not in our lifetime. You can talk to all the scientists and get all the numbers and mash them up different ways and come up with peak oil in 2030 or 2005. You can say it's going to last for another 100 years or another 20, but sooner or later, it's going to end. Sooner or later, all of us or our children or our grandchildren are going to be on the land, or at least most of us. So we've taken as kind of our personal journey to fight for renewal of this to through principles of permaculture primarily to found a new way of living. And I apologize to all of you who are hopeful that cities are going to be the answer. I think in the long term they aren't, and you may be hanging on in the short term. And I encourage you to do the best you can in your cities because they will be necessary for helping those of us who are trying to bridge to a future agrarian society. So please don't think that I'm putting anyone down for living in a city or staying in a suburb or anything like that. It's going to take a lot of effort from a lot of different people. As for the film, I'm delighted, saddened, flattered, and humbled to be involved with it. and I hope each of you take a good message from it. And again, as others have said, it's a call to action. We can say government should do this, industry should do this, business should build these kinds of products, technology should do this, but it's going to be up to each one of us to find a path that will take us through this energy crisis in the best way possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan.
I just, when Jan was speaking, I had a quote here. This is from U.S. Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman, and he said this back in November 13th, 2006, at the Middle East Institute's 60th anniversary. He says, quote, "Even with all the technical expertise the world could offer and all the political will it could muster, eventually we will run out of oil. And even before then, the price of a dwindling supply will be prohibitive. At present, our world is overly focused on and overly dependent upon one source of energy, and that path is unsustainable." You know, when you hear that from people up in charge, the people up at the very top, especially from the U.S. administration, I think that it really requires you to do a second thought and to do your own homework. And anyways, it's a pleasure to have you here, Jan. Ifni?
Yeah, it is very much a pleasure, and it was a pleasure to sit beside you and your partner, and all three of us watched the movie for the first time, which was quite delightful. I think I was debating about whether or not to wear a red dress to tonight's thing. If this is the funeral for peak oil, it's kind of a bittersweet thing, and maybe I think maybe one of the reasons that the traditional environmentalist community has not communicated so much with the peak oil people is because for maybe a lot of environmentalists, it's actually not the worst news. You know, really, well. It's so bittersweet, I don't know why we're applauding, but I think when we talk about, I mean, it's interesting, I do want to say that I totally disagree with you, Rex. We haven't hit the peak of everything. We haven't hit the peak of stupidity.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, you know, having now very logistical difficulties before us, I think people are starting to really say, oh, you know, I can't afford to buy gas for my oversized vehicle. And that's a great thing when we're looking at the bottom line. I think that people saying, you know, congestion is terrible and I don't want to drive to work anymore. I'm going to live closer to where I work. Those very day-to-day things, I think, are really important for people to realize that there are bigger forces at work and they're impacting people on a daily basis. So in some ways, I'm quite excited to see, you know, what we have to do collectively next. And when people talk about peak oil and, oh, my God, it's going to be anarchy, well, actually, that's really good. Anarchy is very much about mutual cooperation and sharing and taking, you know, not passing by a problem, but actually, you know, taking the initiative and problem solving together and coming to consensus about what we should do and all these really outdated and kind of, no offense, rustic ideas that really are going to save our butts. So, you know, I'm a cycling advocate. I do a radio show and, I also, as Justin mentioned, decided with a few other people in the community to start a computer recycler, but really it's a reuse center. And it's if we're talking about, you know, a lot of people talk about, well, we don't have to sacrifice anything. We can be green and still have all the goodies we want. That's a bit disturbing. And I very much agree with the work that Conrad has done about, you know, awareness raising of consumption levels. We really have to start thinking about, do we really need all of the things that we've been told over and over through various media that we need? We don't actually need to go that far. So I would really encourage people to think about how they can reuse the things that they have or start making new network connections in the community to see if there's somebody in your community who needs those things after you are finished with them. Scavenging is a fabulous form of conservation that, you know, our grandparents knew about and people have done for time immemorial. As long as there have been humans around, there have been trash heaps and they've been rooted through. So, you know, thinking about ways that you can, I mean, you look at freegans, the freegan movement, and for those of you who don't know, that's it's primarily vegan, but you can eat it if it's free. So, you know, looking in restaurant dumpsters and things like that for produce that has been, you know, that's no longer cosmetically pretty but is perfectly nutritious. So basically we're getting back to some really kind of simple ideas, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle, resist, relocalize, reinvent, and there are some really smart ideas that also people can do on a daily basis, and one of them, of course, is ride a bicycle, but also don't take any shit anymore. When, you know, federal governments and provincial governments are moving too slowly for you, we have a very large impact on municipal governments, and I would strongly encourage people to get really noisy and get really out there and be really public and start, you know, having meetings or finding free spaces that you can have. You know, you can just call a meeting, put it on Craigslist, put it anywhere. You can organize this stuff. It doesn't take a specialist. Nobody's going to save us. You'll be really happy to, you know, make connections with the people that in 10 years from now you can actually barter with, right? Start thinking about things that you can create that you can barter. So I guess another piece of practical advice. I got really excited. I get excited when I get to watch a movie because I don't have that much time to do it anymore, but I would say if you're not really busy at this point, you might want to reconsider what your priorities are because there's a lot of things that we have to do. Oh, do you know what? I have to say two more things.
Go ahead.
I have to disagree with another panelist. I'm sorry, and we haven't even officially met yet. I do want to say about electric cars, too, that I really think that, again, this is that whole issue of I want to have the convenience at my fingertips and do the things that I'm accustomed to being able to do in this really luxurious you know, society that we've created. Well, you know what? Cars originally were luxury items, and they are. They have been. The costs have been hidden to us for a long time. But, you know, there's no reason that everybody needs an individual one. We need to start sharing our tools with one another, and one of them would be, you know, this really quick and easy transportation item. Another thing I want to say that hadn't been mentioned too, and this relates to something Conrad said about things that were missed in the movie, there wasn't really too much talk about biofuel. And I think that people need to start freaking out about biofuel and start getting really angry about it and then use that anger in a constructive way. Because biofuel, there are 800 million people in the world who are chronically malnutrition, suffering from malnutrition, and yet we're turning food into fuel? I mean, I did a little bit of reading just kind of in preparation because I knew it'd be coming here today, and I started reading some things and getting really freaked right out. So everybody, let's all freak out and try to stop the production of biofuels because it's totally unsustainable. It's kind of like a chronic alcoholic drinking mouthwash to get drunk. It's not appropriate anymore. We have to stop living like this.
She's right. 15. Yeah, and maybe we should make a distinction here. I mean, if you grew your own garden and produced your own biofuel, maybe that's different than big, gigantic agribusiness making their own biofuel. And another thing is I think we tend to look at these things like peak oil as some singular moment in time. Well, singular, there is no singular moment in time. Peak oil is not, wasn't yesterday and it won't be tomorrow. It's going to be spread over a long period of time. And like Rex said, we don't know when it's going to affect us. It's probably going to affect us last. But let's not think of things as singular moments in time and think of one solution. There isn't one solution. There isn't fuel cells. There isn't biofuels. There isn't really, the only solution is, the main solution is conservation, from what I can tell. I mean, if you can cut back what you need and what you use, you're going to save money, you're going to save the environment, and maybe you don't need to earn as much money. Maybe you can use that extra time to enjoy family and things that you enjoy, and maybe that's just one answer. And maybe answers are different for different people in different parts of time, in different points of time. So, thanks, Ifni.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock, and this is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio on the Far Coast, Vancouver, Canada.
And Richard.
I'm not sure where to start on this, but to give you a link of where we're coming from lately, I was on the Planning Commission for 4 years, and we did something that we were asked not to do or requested not to do. We had something called Strategic Sustainable Planning Seminars. We had two of them, 2005-2006. We put people into the future where not just peak oil is happening, but global warming. And everybody went through a Mad Max scenario because they didn't cooperate. And you can find these reports in the background data on the site at plancanada.com, if those that are taking notes. How do I make this leap? I think to put it into perspective, if you take a look at the Huppert's curve that looks like that, and we passed the peak according to Huppert's curve in 1970, it really doesn't matter much whether he's off 5, 10, 15, or 20 years. He's off. We're into a really period of bad trouble here. And we've got some people who want to deny that there's a problem. The trouble is, if we listen to them, it means that if they're wrong, we're all in trouble. So I think it's probably safer to take a look at the problem and see what you can do to solve it. And coming from a, you know, architect and planner point of view, when we did these seminars, we took a look at it from the urban plan point of view, because if you take a look at Huppert's curve of the consumption of any resources on the planet, when we passed through that peak, we created cities in a pattern of community based upon cheap energy. And when the cheap energy is gone, that pattern of community doesn't work anymore. So what do we have to do? We have to change the pattern of community in a very short period of time with fewer resources in which to do it with. So we have a problem. If you take a look at the historical, the geological period of consumption of not just oil, but the major resources on the planet, you've got a long line with a big peak right here. 150, 200 years of the smartest creature on the planet consuming all the resources in a very short period of time. The few grandchildren we're going to have left in a few, you know, say in 100 years, are not going to thank us for us doing that to them. The other thing about consuming all that energy in a short period of time is it's millions of years of energy going off in a 200-year period. It's like a bomb going off on the planet. Why do we think global warming isn't happening? Well, I don't know. Anyhow, I suggest you take a look at those papers. I think I've lost my link up here because I haven't been sleeping lately, partly trying to get this. We're trying to put a manual out on this topic. It's called the SSP Manual, a Manual for Cultural Survival. It's actually a civil defense manual. Part of the reason for doing this, I was going to do a PhD a few years back, one of those late-in-life things, and in trying to research what governments in the world were really dealing with this. In North America and Europe was way ahead of us. There was no real proactive planning going on. Nobody was really trying to figure out how to stop what could go wrong when populations destabilize, or you have mass migrations as people flee the lack of energy, or global warming, the interior of the continents baking, or tides rising. The only people that are really dealing with that are the police and the armed forces, which means they're dealing with it after it goes wrong. And that's why I got involved more in this, because I don't want to see us go through that kind of destabilization scenario. That's why when everybody says here, let's find a way to cooperate, that's the key message here, and that's why you're here, and that's why I'm glad to see you. So go out, and there was a sign in one of those T-shirts in the movie. It said, quit your bitching and start a revolution.
Thank you, Richard. Okay, we have about 15 minutes for questions, so we'll take questions from the audience. And if you can direct them at a panelist, that would be great. And I'm just going to come around with the microphone. I got my first question right here.
Okay, this is to anybody, actually. The part in the movie that got me thinking was the transformation of suburbs. And, you know, we have a lot of suburban areas around here in Vancouver with big houses and all gridded out in a grid, like with yards, big yards. And thinking about do any of you know of a real example somewhere in the world where a suburb has actually been transformed? Not farmland, not, you know, empty spaces, because I've heard of lots of those kind of examples, but where we could actually get some areas of Surrey or even parts of Vancouver and everywhere to be turned into walkable center places and places that grow food. If there are any examples of the conversion that from what used to be a typical suburb. So,
does anybody want to take that one on?
There's some in London.
Richard?
Or in England, but I don't know where.
I hate to say this, but some of these things are going to happen. You're going to be a pioneer in dealing with them. They haven't happened before. We haven't really had the reversals. And there is a paper on the Plan Canada website that was given at the agricultural section of the World Urban Forum in 2006, and it deals with re-ruralization of the suburb. And what that there's another paper that's going to be presented in Nelson on this issue, and it's about some cities are not sustainable. Vancouver's not a sustainable city. Sorry. The things we're doing here are baby steps. The things we're doing in Vancouver right now are baby steps. You should take them, but we need to take bigger ones. And what it means is that if cities are not sustainable, some are going to get 10 times bigger and some are going to get 10 times smaller as they find their level of sustainability. What can the local population, or what local population can be sustained by the farmland and the other resources in the area? Which triggers another thought. The Club of Rome report was not wrong in general scope. We are running out of certain things. I mean, there's an engineering student at UBC that's trying to figure out how to do curbside recycling of urine. You know why? Because we're finding it hard to get phosphorus. That means your heart has to keep ticking if it has phosphorus, but if it doesn't have, that means we've got to recycle it. That's just a little anecdote to show you, you know, we're running out of metals. The population's going up around the world. China wants a higher level of standard of living. Anyhow, back to your question. We're going to have changes in the pattern of community. Your goal is to try and figure out how to do it before we need to do it.
Yeah, go ahead, Jan.
I think the reason, I saw everyone scratching their head up here, the reason is that it hasn't happened is because there's still too much energy. And if anyone wants a good example of how to survive peak oil, look to Cuba. CommunitySolution.org has a film out, and I'm sorry, I don't know the exact name, but it has Cuba in the name.
How Cuba survived peak oil. How Cuba survived peak oil is, I think,
there
it's called.
There you go. Yeah. How basically Cuba went through this special period when the Soviet Union collapsed, and they were still under U.S. embargo and stopped getting oil supplies. In 4 years, they transformed the entire country from industrialized agriculture into organic farming. It can be done. There are no examples of a suburb, but there's a wonderful example of an entire country having done it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jan. We have another question over here.
All right. Hi, my name is Saul Pasos Knop. I am doing a PhD on fuel cells at UBC. And this question is for Mr. Smith. I am from Paraguay, and I say that because some part of the movie remind me Paraguay, especially the part with the cows and the milk and agricultural products and so on. I saw the film like kind of idealistic. For example, when I was a child in Paraguay, we used to buy the milk from the cow directly until we got some pasteurized milk from Argentina. So what did we do then? We started producing pasteurized milk and UHT milk in Paraguay as well. So we need to compete with Argentina, and perhaps Argentina has to compete with Brazil, and everyone has to compete with each other buying cheap products. And I think the key point here, the key word here is cheap. How are we going to pay for these people that actually grew up the vegetables and take care of the cows? And because they are labor, we have to pay for them. And we are always thinking in cheap products, cheap everything. And how can we possibly pay for people that work on that?
So is the question how are we going to support local agriculture versus buying a cheap product?
Exactly.
Conrad, you want to take that on?
That's a fairly tough question. I think there are multiple facets to that. And it, for me, I see it as that we do have to have some type of protection for local farmers as well. The whole idea of a race to the bottom doesn't make any sense. Who can produce the cheapest product? You have to have some protection. Europe does have protection for some of its farmers. It has to exist, and we can't combine them.
If I can just make a brief comment on that too, I think those people are artificially poor. I mean, they're exploited. They're growing monocultural crops that are primarily used for export. If you look at and that now will be continued with food production for biofuels. If you look at the price of corn, it's doubled since last year. And in Mexico, they're starting to riot and things like that as well. They should. So, you know, I think that there will be a readjustment period. So, for example, for food producers in Paraguay, they'll start to go back to cultivating, you know, food for the local communities, and they'll be growing more things, and they'll have stuff to trade, so, or they'll have stuff to, if we still end up using money, they'll be able to sell it. But, you know, ultimately I think it's agriculture as we know it has to be completely transformed, particularly with the use of pesticides. You know, you look at all the bees dying, and of course bees are responsible for pollinating most of the food that we eat, and we're reintroducing new pesticides on a yearly, the neonics, which are a variant of nicotine that we're using as a pesticide. That's been theorized to be the reason why all these bees are disappearing. No one's even seen their little furry corpses, so...
Yeah. Colony collapse disorder, I think is what it's called.
I think I understand that question a little bit better now. The question is, the part of the movie, the solution that they're proposing is everybody head back into the land and grow your own food and support and grow economies locally. But the point that's being raised over here is, with big business busy producing so many crops, how do small farms become sustainable? For people, I don't know the answer. Currently, there is a growing organic industry, but a lot of farms on the islands, they don't actually make a profit. They can't compete. It's a very good point. And to be fairly honest, I don't have a clear answer how you solve that problem.
I think part of it, too, is what is your idea of making a profit? One of the things that my wife and I have been doing is going to the farmer's market in Kitsilano on weekends. And, you know, for us, we pay a premium. We're lucky enough and we have enough money and we're fortunate enough to be able to pay to buy organic, locally produced food. And that seems to work for us. I mean, it may not work for everybody, but I think at the end of the day, it really is, what is the idea of wealth? If your idea of wealth is having a Mercedes and a big house and developing, then being on your own land and growing your own food may not bring you that wealth, where it may bring you your own local, you know, sustainability. So it's really your perception of what wealth is.
I'd like to just add it to that. Basically, sustainable farming is the way we used to do it, where you had all these different crops on a small plot of land, you had animals, you rotated your crops, and that's the way to have sustainable farming. Anything that's done by a large corporation has to be monoculture. It's the only way to go. The reason that bees are dying, one of the reasons is because there's only one breed of bees. They've multiplied the bees, so there's only one generic footprint of them. So they contract one disease. They're apparently dying of a disease like AIDS. And it's just one strain, so it wipes out, and that's 95% of the pollinating bees, and it wipes out. I mean, the whole issue with the genetic modified foods, the granola thing in Saskatchewan a few years ago, where a big, huge corporation like Monsanto rolls over a farmer and basically wipes him out. And they say, you're imposing on our patents. I mean, this is all about big business. And I think what people have to do is realize, what's the best food you can eat? Where can you spend your money? And for me, I've decided that I want to spend more money on food, so I support local farmers, organic farms here in the valley, and we buy from farmers markets. And because for me, that the best return on investment for me is to buy the best food I can get, and that's by supporting local. And whenever you get a mass-produced, you know, even a company like Whole Foods, which is built around organic foods, these guys are now buying up Wild Oats, one of their biggest competitors right now, and They get so large. Walmart wants to get into the organic craze. Well, Walmart cannot produce organic food. It's impossible because you can't do it on such a large scale. So it's about consumers demanding what they want. I mean, what Guy Donsey was saying about organic food and healthy food. You buy hothouse tomatoes, they're tasteless. They look perfect, but they're tasteless because they're all monoculture. There's no variation in the formula that produces them.
Can I add something to that?
Can we go on to the next question, just because we're running out of time here? And
I'm from a really small town, and I hated it. And I left as fast as I could, and I moved as far away as I could. And I have a baby now, and I'm seriously considering moving back because I can't see her growing up and being in a community where we have to buy food from an organic producer because, first of all, I don't shop at anything with a bigger parking lot than an actual square footage in the inside of the store. So, because I don't have a car. So to go to a store with a bigger parking lot than the inside of the store doesn't make any sense to me. So we go to farmers markets, we buy local, we buy from local stores, we do all that other stuff. But I am terrified that the bees are going to die and that there's not going to be any food and we're going to be stuck in Vancouver and we're going to die of starvation because we can't get food. But anyway, that's because I'm paranoid. I don't want her to live in the town of 500 white people that I grew up in and felt like I was going to die of claustrophobia and just general boredom. Is there any way to save the best parts of the city and like the movies and the petrochemical discussion groups and the everything else without actually living in a really boring little town in the middle of nowhere?
Well, I'll just make one stab at that, because I think part of the problem of this, our entire industrialized culture, is the destruction of community. So the little town that you grew up in, probably a lot of the people that are there, the community sense of that little town and a lot of the little towns has been destroyed because people are working for large corporations. They're doing industrial farming, or there's some industrial plant there that's keeping them all going. So the sense of the sense of families and communities working together, feeding each other, taking care of each other, making their own music, creating their own entertainment, those kinds of small towns in the industrial world have been disappearing for 200 years or more. There's a lot of places in the world where that small town, small village life is going on just fine, and they are probably going to be they're going to be the most sustainable communities. I mean, there's places in Asia now where they're doing little micro hydro. I mean, you can put a Pelton wheel in a little stream and at least get enough electricity that kids can hook up to the internet and Google stuff and learn stuff and further their own education, and you can have enough electricity to do a minor few little things that'll help the community. But you don't, you know, the centralized, industrialized way of going about things that Conrad made an allusion to, you know, going for trying to create the cheaper and cheaper and cheaper products to compete economically, it's just not a viable solution to humanity. And, you know, I've seen studies where people say, oh, yeah, we can feed 7 billion people. We can feed 12 billion people on the planet. But to do that, you're talking about turning the entire planet basically into these industrial farms. I was down in Argentina trying to help out the Huichi Indians there and managed to save some land for them down there. But it's like a drop in the bucket. What I saw down there, night and day, 24 hours a day, it's like unbelievable. 7 days a week, the bulldozers going like panzer divisions. I remember here, you know, you've heard about the destruction of the rainforest. And, you know, I had in my mind a completely different picture. This is going on dawn to dusk, 7 days a week, panzer divisions of bulldozers just turning rainforest into these huge plantations. So I think that one of the problems with the sort of small town that you're talking about is it's a sort of post-industrial small town. That's not the way people lived, you know, hundreds of years ago. And in fact, you know, getting back to that sense of community, even in a city, even in a neighborhood, and you were talking about that, you know, and you saw those people in East L.A. Once people are planting things, working together, hanging out together, doing stuff for people, giving them boxes of food, you have that community sense comes back. And that has to be, because, you know, all of the things that our kids do for entertainment, running around with electronics in entertainment and the electronic games and going to movies and all this sort of purchased entertainment, is because our communities have lost the ability to even entertain themselves. And we think we have to get our music off of some electronic system. People don't realize you can make your own music. It's a lot more fun. It's a lot more fun to put on your own local plays and entertain yourselves than it is to buy all your entertainment along with everything else. So anyway, part of the solution is to recreate the sense of community even in those small towns.
I don't think we can go past hearing from Jan about this, because I'll say two really quick things and then I want to hear what he says, and I know
let me just make a quick comment here. We could probably go on for hours, and I would love to go on for hours. We have to be out of here at 10:30. So unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. If Jan would like to say a couple more comments, that would be great.
I suspect the community you're talking about is a function of cheap energy. I can't tell your age from back here, but I suspect that the community was perverted by cheap energy. And I'd encourage you to seek out intentional community. There's a movement about where people seek people of like mind, pool their resources, bring property, get together, learn how to live together in new ways. An excellent author on the subject, Diana Leaf Christian, she wrote Creating a Life Together for EcoVillage and Intentional Community Founders. She has a brand new book out called Finding Community for people who seek to join a community of like-minded people. So I think to avoid this product of cheap energy, go out and find people who want to do what you want to do.
And that's the, and I really think that people like Jen, who is totally an awesome, these people are going to be fleeing to the countryside. So small communities are going to spring up that are going to be totally exciting and totally revolutionary and fertile and all this stuff. I want to say that I'm a total Luddite as well. And remember that the Luddites are very misunderstood. The Luddites actually were mainly objecting to poor workmanship and technology basically defining their day structure. And so, you know, we can actually heal the ills of the Industrial Revolution. We're being given that opportunity, and we're being forced to take that opportunity. So I hope that everybody goes home. I hope you all meet your neighbors, start Victory Gardens, start riding your bike as much as possible, and meet the person sitting next to you if you don't know them.
Thank you. Can I get a round of applause for the panelists?
You've been listening to an intriguing mix of panelists working with an enthusiastic crowd at the Ukrainian Hall, August 17, 2007, in Vancouver. Find out more about the film Escape from Suburbia from escapefromsuburbia.com. Some of the organizers for this event can be found at www.submedia.tv. You can find our interview of the director, Gregory Green, in the Energy Files at our site, www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. The panelists, in the order they spoke, were Conrad Schmidt, founder of the Work Less Party and the World Naked Bike Ride, John Stonier, director of the BC Sustainable Energy Association, Jan Steinman from the film The Tech Guru, who says it's time to leave town, Ifni LaChance, a working activist, and she's with the Free Geek Computer Recycling Company. And finally, Richard Balfour is an architect and city planner. I'm Alex Smith, and be sure and tune in next week for our season-opening blockbuster two-show special on Planktos. That's the carbon offset company the Pope uses. They're working to plant new forests, forever forests, in Hungary and lately in Haida Gwaii, known to the white man as the Queen Charlotte Islands. But Planktos is taking heavy fire from Greenpeace, the World Wildlife Fund, and even an intergovernmental ocean group, because their CEO, Russ George, also intends to artificially seed algae in the far Pacific Ocean. George says the oceans are dying, and we need to invent new technologies to grab billions of tons of carbon dioxide out of the air or suffer on a damaged planet. Lots of people hate the idea, and some question the business promotion behind the scheme, but next week we'll spend the whole hour talking about depleted ocean life, algae farming, and permanent forests to save the planet. Next week, Russ George, CEO of Planktos, meets Alex Smith. Let's get together then. Meanwhile, send your questions, suggestions, complaints, and rotten tomatoes to radio@ecoshock.org. This is CFRO FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.